Steve, I've heard you describe sleep as a performance-enhancing drug. And if there's one way to sell sleep to me, that is definitely the way to do it. I'm all about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's ironic because we just did our essentials of movement and exercise. And we talked about Exerzac, right? Where you take all the effects of exercise, capture it in a pill. And here we are with the drug metaphor again. But again, it's completely warranted. So here's the deal. Okay, I want to zoom out. I want to look over the landscape at 30,000 feet. We're looking down on the whole terrain. We got to start with a question. Why the hell do we sleep? I mean, it's a profound mystery. It goes back thousands of years. People have wondered, like, really, medically, philosophically, however you want to come at the question, why do we need sleep? And the answer, which we've only really, really known at any level of detail for 30, 40 years, is we sleep because the brain wears itself out every day. Because brain cells, while we're awake, are firing up to 100, 200 times every second. The average brain cell fires 10 times every second. That's a lot of activity over the course of a day. And so I think several months ago, we talked about brain cells, neurons as like high performance Formula One race cars. They're just like exquisitely brilliant machines.
You know, that was in our very first episode. That was all about the link between COVID and depression. Wow.
I believe
nice.
It was. Yeah.
Nice
yeah,
callback.
Yeah, a little callback. Yeah.
Yeah. To the pilot episode.
To the pilot episode. Cool. Calling. Wow. Yeah. The producer's going to be really excited about that. So a Formula One race car, it's this incredible performance machine, but also very high maintenance. And right. It needs to come in for a pit stop every once in a while. You got the pit crew and they do all their thing. They got to refuel it. They got to change out filters that get clogged with toxins and whatever, and put new tires because they're worn out. And that's like our brain cells every night after a day of they're doing their high performance race through life. And they need that extended pit stop. And so you can imagine now a race, Formula One car doesn't get a pit stop, or maybe its pit stops are only 70%, 60%, 50% as long as they need to get all the things done. Well, over the course of an entire race, it's not going to be performing the way it was designed to perform. That car is not going to win the race. And so that's like us when we're sleep deprived. And so it is literally the very lowest of all the low-hanging fruit for performance enhancement, for life enhancement, for well-being enhancement. If we are not getting that adequate pit stop, both in terms of the quality of what happens during the pit stop, as well as the quantity, just like, does the road crew have enough time to get everything done? Then the simplest thing we can do and the most powerful to increase our mental clarity, our mental performance, our memory, our mood, our focus, everything, it's going to be improving our sleep. And it's absolutely staggering how many people out there have no idea that they're just running depleted. They're running the race really without the adequate fuel. And they've got all these toxins that are building up. And it's like, dude, just really take this seriously. This is so important.
Their Formula One car is just like driving like a beater. They're like, dude, why do I feel so terrible? Why am I so sluggish? It's like, well, I guess we're about to find out.
By the way, can I just say something for our listeners really quickly? I have a daughter who's brilliant and wonderful and really one of the greatest joys of my life. She's a young woman, and she teases me every once in a while. She's like, Dad, your metaphors, your images, they're great, but they have more appeal to the typical guy than to the typical young woman. Like, maybe you should back
right,
off
so on... Picture this. You know your muscle cars, right? Okay, perfect. Well, the carbine defibrillator, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, like that. So I just wanted to reflect that to any of our listeners who are not really into car metaphors. I promise I'm going to bring out some less sort of bro-y, less stereotypically male masculine stuff. That's one of my resolutions for the second half.
Is that a stretch goal? I don't even know if that's possible, dude.
I may not have mentioned this, Hugh, but I'm a big fan of psychological androgyny. Carl Jung said all of us have a male and a female side.
Okay.
To our psyche, the animas, all of us have a male and female component. And I think it's a beautiful way of thinking about the wholeness that we can aspire to, a kind of psychological androgyny, as it were. I have a sensitive feminine side, and I'm getting in touch with it.
Well, look, I expect to see a lot more of the feminine side of Steve in the rest of this episode. So the gauntlet has been thrown down.
Oh,
that is your challenge for the rest of this episode.
This episode? that's a lot of pressure. I'll do what I can.
What the heck is this show? My goodness. Welcome to Mental Health, the show where we discuss the latest tools, the ancient practices, the cutting-edge research, the female sides of Professor Steve. We do it all on this show, and it's all to help us take back control of our emotional well-being. My name's Hugh James. I'm a writer. I'm a podcaster from Ireland. I've been on a journey of recovery from addiction and depression over the last 15 years. And this superstar himself, go ahead. Who are you?
Oh. That's hilarious. Thank you for that comedic intro. I'm Steve Ilardi, everyone, and I'm a clinical psychologist. I'm a researcher. I'm a professor. I'm a writer. I'm an NBA consultant.
Woo-hoo! Let me just take that one step further. You're looking / listening to a gentleman who invented a new metric in the NBA. That is pretty cool. I was talking
to
one of my clients the other day, and I was bragging on you, and he Googled you. And the guy's a basketball fan, and he came back and says, dude, this guy invented a metric in the NBA. And I didn't know that yet because it just had kind of broke, I think. And I was like, oh, yeah, he's a big deal. And I immediately proceeded to like Google it later.
Well, that's very, very kind. It's funny. So I started in NBA analytics about 20 years ago as just a side thing, just a labor of love, just a hobby. Okay, it's a hobby. My day job, university professor, psychologist, researcher, writer. But man, what a blessing, what a charmed life to have a hobby that turns into something that you can actually do. So anyway, yeah, I've worked for a couple of NBA teams on the side. I've written for a while for ESPN, and I helped them develop a metric. If anybody wants to look it up, it's called Real Plus Minus, Real Plus, or RPM, Real Plus Minus. And yeah, it's gained a little traction, so I'm happy about it. I'm way more passionate about the mental health work that we do. But it's fun to have hobbies as well. So anyway, thanks for the shout out there. Let's talk about sleep though here.
I'm going to do a really forced transition here. Are you ready?
Oh, God. Yes.
Well, Steve, speaking of metrics, a question that I had for you today was actually, how much sleep do we need? Okay, because there's a couple of different things flying around the place. Like, give it to us straight up. Don't beat around the bush. Like, don't give us anything unnecessary. Like, we want to know straight from the source itself. Of scientific knowledge, how much sleep can I get away with having if I want to function optimally?
Oh, what a smooth transition there. Yeah, so I think all of us probably remember, many of us who've been parents or have younger siblings or done a lot of babysitting, we know that kids need more sleep than adults, and young children can need really 12 hours a night. Why do they need more? Because their brain is still...
Because their parents need a rest.
Well, yeah, that too. But... they're learning so much new content, right? Everything is new. Their brain is still wiring itself up. And so their brain has a lot more need for a very intensive pit stop every night. And so they need little kids, like 10, 12 hours. And that really all the way up into early adolescence, about 10 hours a night. And then here's the thing that almost nobody remembers, but teenagers, we're talking about like high school age kids, really need about 9.5 hours a night to thrive optimally. And there's mountains of experimental evidence to show that they will function so much better academically, mentally, cognitively, psychologically, in terms of their resistance, resilience psychologically to stress, resistance to depression, anxiety, if they're getting 9.5 hours a night. The average non-adolescent adult, so let's just say the average adult. I'm not going to give adolescents credit. They're not in the club.
Two positives.
I'm going to draw a line.
A positive. No, two minuses make a positive.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. I know. So the average adult needs between 7 and 9 hours a night. And there's a lot of individual difference. Some people are much more efficient sleepers. They've got a more efficient pit crew. maybe the brain isn't working quite as hard during the day.
They're just coasting their way around the track. They're not even really pumping the gas. They're just like freeloading.
As somebody who is maybe a little higher on sleep need than I like to admit sometimes, I really do thrive on 8 hours a night. Sometimes it's like it's usually about 8 hours. I wish I could be one of those people that gets 6 or 7. I'm not. I mean, I can do it for a night or two. But anyway, I like to think, yeah, because maybe my brain cells are working hard in the day.
For achiever, let's be honest, like, that's a good scale, you know? Like, if 7 hours is not enough for you, it's like, you're probably working too hard.
I don't know what it is. Most of the people I admire who get the most done seem to be the short sleepers.
You'll get them in the long grass, man. Come on, it's sustainable productivity. This is what we're preaching here. Do they have an MBA metric? I highly doubt it. God, come on. And the quick note on teenagers, though, like, I think teens get a pretty bad rap for, like, quote unquote, being lazy, quote unquote, sleeping in all the time. I think it's just them just catching up because they need that extra sleep. Their body just has to get it somehow. And if you're not getting to bed at a reasonable hour, your body's going to push you to that long lie-in that, you know, teens are infamous for. But it's just they're just getting what they need.
And let's just take a second to clarify something here. Teenagers in modern society are the victims of a weird sort of societal pressure where their body clocks, there's something, we don't fully understand the evolutionary origins of this, but the body clock of children, elementary school children, tends to be more like an early bird. So their chronotype, their natural circadian rhythm is to boot up very quickly, to wake up early, to crash in the evening, to slowly wind down early. And when they hit adolescence, most kids pivot and they can't help it. This is not social. This is not social contagion. This is not something they're taught or trained or rewarded for. Their brain just goes into the night owl chronotype. And so most teenagers, even if they wanted to fall asleep at 9, let's just say 9 p.m., so they could get their 9 hours before, because a lot of kids in the States, at least, they're getting up at 6 a.m. on a school day because a lot of American high schools start high school at 7:30 a.m., which is bananas. And there's a national movement. I'm not making this up. There's a national movement that's gaining traction to in every school district to say, look, let's let elementary school start because they only have so many school buses. And they're like, well, we got to reuse the same buses for the kids and the high schoolers. And so what they do is they're like, oh, well, the high schoolers are maybe whatever. They're more mature. They can do without the sleep. So we'll have them catch the bus at 7 a.m. It's like, no. You need to reverse it. And so we've got all these American teenagers and probably throughout a lot of the rest of the world that need their 9 hours sleep. And they're getting, maybe they're not even able to fall asleep until midnight because of their chronotype shift. They're becoming, the brain is naturally pushing them to become night owls. And we're forcing them to act like early birds by making them get up at 6 a.m. And should we be surprised that they're falling asleep at their desk and they're constantly struggling with mood disorders and lack of focus? And and by the way, a lot of them who are academically inclined want to get prescriptions or just borrow stimulants from their friends that have a prescription for stimulants, not because they have ADHD, but because they're so chronically sleep deprived that they can mask their sleep deficit to some degree with a stimulant. And they don't need the stimulant, but they're convinced they do because they're just so chronically sleep deprived. So anyway, yeah, the average adult needs 7 to 9 hours.
Can I just yank your chain for a second?
Please.
I was just going to say # make America late again. Anyway, so what are some signs that you're not getting enough sleep? Can you give us any kind of indicators that, because it's hard to kind of be like, you can't really give everybody a number. Like we,
absolutely.
Kind of like we talked about in the exercise episode, like a great kind of point of reference because everyone's heart is different. Everyone's level of fitness is different. You said, you know, you're working hard enough if you can't sing a line from your favorite song. So give us a couple of like little physical indicators that we don't need a fancy aura ring or like some sort of magical device to tell us.
Absolutely. Yeah. So by the way, I'm a big fan of having some sort of biometric tracking device to track, at least to approximate how many hours of sleep you're getting a night. And you can then match up that information with these indicators of whether or not you're getting enough sleep. Why? Because we've said, if you're a typical adult, you need between 7 and 9, but you don't know what your number is. It might be 7, it might be 8, it might be 9. There's a freakish, like 1% of the population that actually thrives on 6 hours or 5, even some 1%. You're probably not in it. So if you're listening or watching and you think you're in the 1%, you're probably not. But you're kidding yourself.
Yeah, you would be out there like being a billionaire or something, you know, like so.
It's not very likely, okay? So let's just assume you need between 7 and 9, but you don't know what your number is. So if you're getting enough sleep and you're tracking like, okay, well, I'm getting 8, is that enough? Or I'm getting 7, is that enough? Well, here's some signs. First of all, if you're getting enough, this is very intuitive, very obvious, kind of blindingly obvious, but you're going to wake up and you're probably going to feel rested when you get up in the morning. You're going to feel refreshed. You're not going to feel a craving for, oh, you're probably not even going to need to use an alarm clock.
I kind of hear like the Disney musical ensemble in my head as you say that, you know, like, good morning, yeah. Good morning, good morning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the scene from Cinderella when the
Perfect.
Little birds
there
are coming in and they're, you know, and she just bounces out of bed and she's all happy and she's singing with the animals. It should be like that.
We'll call that the Cinderella effect from now on. Although, actually, that's already something else.
Dude, I said I was going to get more in touch with my feminine
side.
Oh, you
did
it! I'm dropping Disney princess.
Take a shot for Steve's feminine side. Wow.
Disney princess. By the way, I don't mean to engage in shameless gender stereotyping, but as the father of a little girl who was passionate about her Disney princesses and who watched, I watched them all. And I kind of secretly loved all of it.
Of course.
Yeah, I got to go back and rewatch them sometime. But anyway, it should be like that. If you're getting enough sleep, you wake up feeling refreshed. Oh, this is big. This is even a better tell. Imagine you're in a boring meeting. Imagine you're watching a boring YouTube video. Imagine you're listening to a boring stretch of your podcast. If you get drowsy, you're in a boring meeting and you find yourself getting drowsy. That is unmasking your sleep deficit. That's not supposed to happen. Little kids who are more likely to be adequately rested, when they get bored, they get restless. They don't get drowsy. They get fidgety. That should be your reaction.
Yeah. My tell is if I fall asleep on the subway or the bus, or if I'm rarely a passenger in a car, but when I lived in Manhattan, there would be like a big portion of my time there where I would fall asleep on like 5 minute subway rides, and I was like, dude, you're in a bad place.
Bad place. So yeah, and that speaks to the next tell, which is if you do fall asleep very quickly. And this is going to be counterintuitive for a lot of people, because they think, oh, if you have healthy sleep, then like your head should hit the pillow at night and you should just be out. And that is false. If you're getting enough sleep, we find, and this is a very robust scientific finding, it takes about 10 minutes from the time you crawl into bed, all the lights are out, stimulation is low. It takes about 10 minutes on average, 10 to 15, somewhere in there. If you fall asleep in 5 minutes or less, you are almost certainly severely sleep deprived. You're not supposed to fall asleep that quickly. And so I've got this fancy Aura biometric tracker or a ring.
Ooh.
And it will yell at me because it tracks my sleep, and it will yell at me. I mean, as much as an app can yell, it will yell at me the next morning if I fall asleep too quickly.
Oh my goodness.
It's like, it says your sleep latency from the time your head hit the pillow to the time you were out was 2 minutes. Not good. That's a sign that you need a little bit more sleep. Okay.
Well, like Aura rings aside, what is the spoon test?
Okay. Spoon test. This is my favorite. So this kind of leverages that basic insight. So what I want you to do, if you want to be able to tell, this approximates something that happens in a sleep lab. And full disclosure, back in grad school, I worked for a year in a sleep lab at Duke Med Center. So I got some decent
Do you work for
training.
Big Spoon? Is that what you're about to disclose? You get a percentage of every spoon that gets sold?
No, maybe I work for Big Sleep Lab.
Big Sleep?
But yeah, for Big Sleep. Yeah, there's going to be a royalty check coming in from the Lunesta and the Ambien people. No, I kid. So in a sleep lab, what we would do is bring somebody in the middle of the day. And then, by the way, this works best right after lunch. So imagine it's like, you know, I don't know when you eat lunch, but let's just say 1:30, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay. So it's like 1:30 And dark, you know, blackout curtains, completely pitch dark room, white noise generator, so there's no ambient noise. And we hook you up to just a couple of lightly, hopefully non-intrusive little electrodes that'll be able to tell us whether or not you're falling asleep. And if you fall asleep within 10 minutes in the middle of the day, you are sleep deprived. And the faster you fall asleep, the more sleep deprived. And we would have people in the sleep lab and they would literally be out. They're generating like alpha waves and then REM and like going into deeper sleep within like 30 seconds. And these are people with really severe sleep disorders like apnea or periodic limb movement disorder or other severe sleep deprivation. We can approximate this at home. You don't need any fancy electrodes. All you need is the timer app on your phone. So set a timer and, you know, it's just going to track how much time elapses, but grab a spoon and grab a metal baking sheet and have your arm, you're holding the spoon, have your arm dangling off the side of the bed and the baking sheet below. So if you relax your grip on the spoon, when you fall asleep, as you will let go of the spoon, it's going to hit the baking sheet and that will be the alarm that will wake you up. Look at your phone, see how much time has elapsed. It's brilliant, right? Now, you need to make sure that you have a sleep mask or blackout curtain. So it's got to be close to pitch black and have a fan running or some sort of white noise. So it's got to be basically sensory deprivation to really work. But if you go into your sensory deprivation simulated chamber in your bedroom or wherever, and you're out within 10 minutes, that is a very powerful signal that you need to get more sleep.
This will tell you a lot about me, but I've heard of the spoon test before, but in a different context. So, do you know the painter Dali?
Of course.
Do you know he used the spoon test?
What?
Oh, no. Yes, I know something that Steve doesn't know. Come on, everybody take
okay,
a shot. This is fun. So, Dali actually, like a lot of creatives, like was very interested in the role that sleep played in creativity. And actually, we probably will touch on that in a second. But he found that around the midday when he was starting to get a little bit sluggish, a nap is a very useful thing. I know a lot of creatives use naps. I know a lot of professors use naps. I'm a fan of naps. They're powerful double-edged swords you need to use sparingly, and we'll maybe get into that. But he started doing this thing where he would take the spoon, he would lie down on a sofa, he would fall asleep, and as soon as the spoon hit the floor, he would stand up and he would start painting because he believed that he was kind of like close to reaching this dreamlike state.
Oh, nice.
And it allowed him to kind of implement this kind of very trippy, very creative kind of element into his work. So there you go. That's my only knowledge about the spoon test.
Yeah, no, I love it. And it is true, by the way, that when we very first fall asleep, typically we will go into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, which is more associated with the kinds of surreal, trippy, free association that we think about with Dali's work and that of other folks that are adjacent to surrealism, right?
So what is the role of REM for us mere mortals who are not abstract painters?
Yeah. Well, you know, so Freud believed, I mean, this is still an influential idea to this day, although it was wrong, mostly wrong. Freud believed that we needed, when we dream, and we now know, of course, that we're dreaming when we're in rapid eye movement, REM sleep, that was the critical part of sleep, and that dreaming would be a kind of safety valve for all kinds of pent-up anxiety and stress and pressure and so forth, intrapsychic conflict of one form or another. And we now know this is not really the case so much. Well, first of all, let me just back up just for a second. The most important part of sleep is not even REM sleep. Freud thought it was. Most people think it is. It's not. There are individuals with brain injuries. There are individuals that are on certain kind of medication that suppress dreaming, that suppress rapid eye movement sleep. And they function okay, usually. It's not ideal. And there are some things that...
Dude, I feel terrible if I've had a lot of REM sleep. Like if I've had a lot of dreams, I feel like I need to go back to bed. Like it's like I've been working too hard while I've been sleeping here, dude. Like I don't want that.
Yeah. Okay. So stick a pin in that. So the most important phase of sleep is something completely different. It's called slow wave or delta wave sleep. It's the deepest. Some people have heard of sleep.
Sorry,
stages.
I had a trauma response to the phrase delta wave.
you had a different experience with a delta wave and a virus that shall go unnamed. But yeah, I forgot about your delta wave.
So that's what we refer to as deep sleep. We're talking about the delta wave, yeah.
The delta wave. So confusingly, it goes by about four different names. So
oh, I love that.
Deepest slow wave sleep. So that's what it looks like on an electroencephalogram. These are very broad, slow waves of brain activity. They're sometimes called delta. They're sometimes called stage 3 and 4 sleep, which, to make it even more confusing, modern sleep scientists only call stage 3. So anyway, it's the deepest phase of sleep. It's the most restorative, and it is the part of sleep that we need for tissue repair, for regulating our body temperature, regulating our immune system, regulating our hormones, a lot of memory consolidation. And get this, if we are deprived of that kind of sleep, we get very sick. And we know from studies of laboratory animals that are deprived of it, they will die usually within a few weeks. So the critical, most essential part of the pit stop for our brains, the road crew that comes out when we're in deep sleep, that's the life-saving essential one. The REM is less important, but still very important for performance. So it's a little bit more of a luxury good. And so it turns out that when we've been like really, really sleep deprived, like you said, you stayed up till 3 a.m. the other night when you were traveling, right? So when we're really, really sleep deprived, our brain will want to go immediately into the deep, slow wave sleep because it's like, okay, this we have to have. And then REM is a luxury. And the longer we've been asleep in the night, the more the brain is like, okay, well, we got all the deep sleep in that we need pretty much. Yeah. So now we can let
Matthew fly around like Neo in the Matrix for a while.
Exactly. Now we'll do more of the REM stuff. So what happens there? Well, also some memory consolidation, but it's more high level stuff where we're integrating like stuff that happened to us during the day into existing basically associational structures in the brain so that we can basically kind of incorporate and make sense of what happened and what does it mean and do we have to update any of our schemas or update any of our thoughts. And get this is mind-blowing, and this is kind of a callback to Freud. If something painful happened during the day, during REM we store it and then we detoxify the pain. So we can now remember the painful thing later without being re-traumatized. And it turns out that people who develop PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, after something painful and traumatic, don't have very good REM sleep in the weeks following their trauma. Their REM has been interfered with so that when they pull up those traumatic memories down the road, they're kind of getting re-traumatized by the memory. And that's not the way it's supposed to work. We're supposed to be able to remember everything important about that horrible event, but be able to kind of tolerate it to some degree. And so when Shakespeare said, sleep knits up the raveled sleeve of care, right? It's like Shakespeare was a master psychologist in a lot of different ways. And he breathtakingly anticipated one of the roles of sleep in taking some of the sting and the poison out of difficult experience.
Mate, I feel ashamed to like disrupt such poetry with what I have to say next.
Bring it on.
Steve, we have 10 minutes and we have 10 habits of healthy sleep. These are the essential things that we need to deploy in our lives to give ourselves the best shot turning that beat up car into the high functioning Formula One machine that it was born to be. Sorry, everything again.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but now I'm getting into like high performance mode here. Okay, let me just say this real quick off the jump. These habits of healthy sleep are largely taken from an existing, brilliant, and very effective research evidence-based therapy protocol. It's called CBT, Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, or CBTI. There are apps, free apps that you can download on your phone from the App Store, whether you're on Android or iPhone. The one that I prefer, it's not very flashy, but it's called CBTI Coach. and it's completely free. It was developed by the Veterans Administration of the US, and it's got some great content. So most of this comes from an existing treatment protocol that's been tested head-to-head against insomnia drugs like Lunesta, like Ambien, like Rosarum. And in the long run, this approach tends to work better for most people. So these are powerful things, even though they're going to sound very simple. Okay.
I'll do the first one because I love the first one.
Oh, go for it.
It's basically like doing what teenagers do not do, and that is to go to bed and get up at the same time every single day. So that does a couple of things. It trains your brain to optimize the sleep drive and efficiency. It also gets your body clock kind of used to, okay, this is the time we wake up. This is the time we go to sleep. I like rhythm. I like routine. I am a rhythmic being, and it gets you into the groove literally in your brain. And I was very good at getting up at the same time every single day, not great at going to bed at the same time every day. And as I tried to, and look, life happens, but as I tried to get that window tighter and tighter at the end of my day and setting myself a bedtime again, like the child that I am, I found that I was reaping just humongous benefits from that. So that would be the first thing we'd recommend.
Yeah, brilliant. And so what that does, when we have a schedule, go to bed at the same time, get up at the same time, over the months that we do that, the brain will optimize its sleep circuitry so we get more efficient. So we actually will need less sleep to get, the pit stop gets more efficient. And we also have more sleep drive when bedtime arrives. It's easier to fall asleep at night. So fantastic. So number two, use your bed only for sleep. We want to basically do some Pavlovian, can I use that word? We want to be like Pavlov and the dog. Dog hears the bell, sees the blue light, whatever, and it knows dinner's coming. So it's conditioned to have a physiological response of salivation, even in the absence of the thing that would normally trigger it. We can do like Pavlov, and now the dog is our body. And what's the conditioning? We crawl into bed, we get a powerful wave of sleep. So what does that mean? We don't want to do anything else in bed, so or nearly anything else. This is a family-friendly show, but you don't want to be on your phone in bed. You don't want to be, I mean, you may want to be, but it'd be better for you not to be on your phone and not to be watching TV, even not to be reading. Just have a nice comfy chair nearby where you can get up, save the bed for sleep, and I promise you will condition your brain and your body to fall asleep more quickly, more readily, and to stay asleep as well.
So the third one is to turn the thermostat down 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 3 degrees Celsius. I sleep much better with the window open. Obviously, we don't have hot weather or humidity over here, so that applies to us. Why does sleeping cold feel better?
Yeah, so this is very ancestral. And it used to be thought that when we study Aboriginal groups who lived the way our ancestors did, that the cue for sleepiness was sundown. And was thought, oh, until we actually embedded with and lived with these Aboriginal groups, it was thought, oh, surely they go to bed as soon as the sun goes down. They do not. They stay awake around the campfire doing whatever, telling stories, having fun, until it gets colder. And depending on where they live, depending on their local climate, that could be anywhere between a few minutes, like if it's desert-like, it's very cold as soon as the sun goes down, or it could be a few hours. But once the temperature drops, now that's their cue to sleep. Why? Because they conserve calories. They're going to conserve energy. They're burning too many calories to try to stay awake and keep themselves warm. It's way more efficient for their bodies. They don't need to find as much food if they're sleeping when it's colder at night. So it's a very primal ancestral drive. Turn your thermostat down. You will sleep much better.
Awesome. I'm going to do the next two or three here.
Yeah, do it.
Number four, we say, is to keep your house or your apartment dark for the last hour of night. You've written down here, like to use candles and lamps. It's really funny, whenever I go to Germany, Jackie's parents, they have this really, really bright light in their living room that gets turned on and it stays on. I mean, it is bright. It is very similar. It's like therapeutic life, light box level of brightness. And dude, I honestly, like, you can make fun of me all you want. I actually have started sitting in that living room with sunglasses on in the evening because I can't handle it. Like, and I hate overhead light in general. And I just find that it's like 10 o'clock at night, this absolute sun is beaming down onto me. And I'm like, dude, I need the darkness. Give it to me because I value my sleep. And I think it goes without saying, but it's picking up on those kind of like smaller little habits. Okay, don't put the big light on, as we say over here. Like, I love your idea of candles. It's very hygge vibes, which is Danish term for kind of coziness and happiness. I really enjoy that. Number five, no work or stressful activities. And I love how you have brackets here, or shows in the hour before bedtime. So I'm guessing you're okay with watching shows that aren't stressful. Is that what you're kind of getting
at? Exactly. Yeah, yeah, nice. Yeah. So like a light comedy, something just kind of escapist. What if you like baking shows, or, I mean, that'll put me to sleep very quickly. Gardening.
No high drama.
But no suspense thrillers, nothing with violence, nothing with gore, nothing with, you know, why? Because you're going to be aroused by that. Your fight or flight, your sympathetic nervous system, it needs to calm way down. Basically, think about this. We've all seen little kids who have wise parents who have a wind down bedtime routine. And parents know, they learn with little kids. You've got to start, if you want your child asleep at 8 or 8:30 or whatever, you got to start an hour ahead, or at least 45 minutes ahead. And the best parents have a routine. Like the kid, like they know, oh, there's a ritual. There's a whole thing that we do that leads up to bedtime. We can do that for ourselves as well. Have that bedtime routine. Start about an hour ahead. Turn down the light. Turn down the thermostat. Do the relaxing thing. Get the hell away from your inbox and your email. Whatever you do, don't do any work. Don't do anything stressful. If there are people in your life that are relaxing to communicate with, by all means. If there are some stressful friends or family members or frenemies or mother-in-law, whatever. And by the way, I love my mother-in-law, for the record. But don't do it the hour before bedtime.
The record shall reflect that Alardi loves his mother-in-law.
I really do.
For anyone who may be watching and may try to use anything against him, you cannot use that.
She's a delight. And she's, oh, by the way, she turns 90 next month.
Woo!
So she's still in the game. It's awesome.
You've given me like a new piece of vocabulary now. Like whenever someone calls me or messages me that I don't want to talk to, I'm just going to be like, I can't really talk to you like after 5 p.m. You have to contact me in like daytime hours because you're too stressful.
You're too stressful. Dude, you're not helping my parasympathetic here. So I'm sorry.
Number seven is easy for me. No caffeine afternoon. Yeah, man. I mean, if you value your sleep, and I don't mean to be all up high on my non-caffeinated horse here, but it's going to make a huge difference if you cut yourself off at 12. You may need to do it earlier. You maybe can experiment with a little bit later, but I think for most people, noon is plenty of time.
Yeah, caffeine has a half-life in the body. In other words, half of it gets metabolized and sticks around every 4 to 5 hours. If you, like me, are a fast metabolizer, then you may be able to have a cup of coffee at 1:30. But just know that even if you're a fast metabolizer, you have a cup of coffee, 200 milligrams of caffeine, that's a lot of caffeine, at 2 in the afternoon, by the time your head hits the pillow, you've still got enough caffeine in your system to interfere with your sleep quality, so, and maybe your sleep onset. So yeah, just be careful with that.
Number eight, you're debunking the idea of a nightcap. Talk
yeah,
to me.
No, alcohol. Yeah, so let's talk about alcohol. Alcohol, yes, absolutely. Millions and millions of people around the world have a drink, a nightcap, to help them fall asleep. It's relaxing. It actually does help people fall asleep sometimes. The problem is that it absolutely shoots their sleep quality and quantity all to crap. So they're going to wake up a few hours later, typically, not just because they have to go to the bathroom, but their sleep is going to be fragmented. It's going to be reduced quality. So the pit stop that night is going to be less efficient. They're not going to have as much of the restorative slow wave sleep. They're not going to have as much of the useful REM sleep. Their sleep is just going to be wonky and fragmented and crappy. The more alcohol they have, the closer to bedtime. So one drink, a glass of wine in the evening for a lot of people, no harm, no foul. I thought that was true for me until I got my Oura Ring. Once I started tracking metrics... The data don't lie. I basically almost never drink anymore. And I was never a particularly heavy drinker, but like I used to enjoy the occasional glass of wine, sometimes two glasses of wine, if there were friends around, whatever, in the evening. And every single time, one glass of wine, my Oura Ring will yell at me the next day when I look at my metrics. And it's like, your sleep is not as good. Your heart rate variability, which is a different kind of metric we'll talk about someday, not as good. You're not doing as well. Do you feel it? And I'm like, no, I don't feel it. And it's like, well, we can tell. just cut that shit. Stop that.
The Aura Ring sounds very intrusive. Like, you wake up and it's just like tapping you on the shoulders like, Stephen, have you been drinking again?
It has a little bit of that vibe, I'm not going to lie. Anyway, it's been life-changing, largely for the better, but it has meant that I've been much more attuned to the sleep disruptive effects of alcohol, especially very close to bedtime. So I would just encourage people to start noticing the connection between their sleep and alcohol use. By the way, I just say this really quickly. I have a very famous colleague. I'm not going to mention her name, but...
Britney Spears.
I'm not going to mention... No, she's a colleague.
Sorry, Madonna.
yeah, there you go. She was concerned about some of her... She got an Oura Ring. She was concerned about some of her metrics and asked what I had learned in the few years since I've had it. And I mentioned this connection between alcohol and sleep and alcohol and my metrics. And she's like, oh, I've never thought of that. I'm going to try not drinking for the next month. And I saw her tweet recently and she said, I've been off alcohol for 2 years once I started noticing how it affects my well-being. And by the way, I like to have a good time. I love the taste and experience of alcohol. So please don't think I'm one of those people. I'm not going to judge you. I really love alcohol. I sound like I'm trying to get on the Supreme...
I would love to clip that. I might actually clip that and send it to you. I really love alcohol.
I sound like I'm trying to get on U.S. Supreme Court or something. I love beer. But this actually happened at a confirmation hearing. I don't drink anymore, or very, very rarely, because I just feel better when I don't. That's all I can say. Part of that may be age effects. We don't detoxify as efficiently as we get a little bit up there in years. So your mileage may vary. But I would just say, be honest with... That's the most important thing. Be honest with yourself. Start noticing. And, you know, there is a connection there.
Awesome. 9 and 10, man. Land the plane. Let's do it.
Okay. So we've all had the experience, I'll bet, of crawling into bed and we got to get up the next day. It's an important day. It's a big day. We're trying to fall asleep. And what I would tell you is there is a paradox here. The harder you try to fall asleep, the more it's guaranteed that you will not.
It's Christmas Eve.
Exactly. Never, never try to fall asleep. Why? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? So how do we actually fall asleep? We crawl into bed with a tired body and a quiet mind. So if your mind is quiet, if your body is tired, you know that feeling. You've got a wave of drowsiness. Your brain has kicked in that sleep drive. It's released melatonin, a sleep hormone, which will naturally be released, especially if you've gotten some movement during the day, especially if you've gotten some sunlight during the day. And now it's ready to give you that big burst of melatonin to make you feel some drowsiness. And you just lay there, and your own particular set of thoughts as you go to sleep may vary. Those of us who've done any mindfulness meditative training, we might just do sometimes, if my mind is particularly busy, I'll just like count my breaths, or I will start to play a round of golf. And I'm not a golfer. I literally have not picked up clubs in about 10 years, but I used to play as a kid, as a teenager with my dad. And so I can still remember some courses. I might replay a stretch of a favorite basketball game that I've watched or even played in, whatever it is, like just sort of a little bit of focus, and I'll drift off. Now, give yourself 20 minutes from the time you crawl into bed. If you have not fallen, and by the way, don't be looking at your clock or your watch or anything, but you can sort of guesstimate what 20 minutes is. If you've been laying there for 20 minutes and you haven't fallen asleep, it's because you got into bed and you didn't have a tired body and a quiet mind. So now get up. It's okay. Get up, go to a quiet, dark place. And I would suggest that you read something can I use a fancy word? Soporific, sleep inducing, something relaxing, something... Not a suspense thriller
novel. No Stephen
novel.
King.
No Stephen. Yeah, God forbid. No horror. I mean, for me, I can pick up one of my wife's gardening magazines or something, or just something that's very peaceful and relaxing. If you're going to watch a video, make sure there are a lot of puppies and cute animals and like that. Just very, like, that'll put you in a very calm, soothed, relaxed sort of state. And then as soon as you feel a little twinge of drowsiness, that's your cue. Go ahead and crawl back into bed. And that's how we train our brain to fall asleep once we're in bed. The paradox is you have to let go. It's like floating in water. You have to let go. You can't try to float. You just have to float.
That's a nice way to end. That got very kind of philosophical at the end there. I like when we do that, you know, that's kind of fun. Very nice.
That was for you, Hugh, because I know that you have some place to be and I've gone over. And so I was trying to make it up to you there just a little bit with just a little dollop of philosophy.
I receive your flowers. Thank you, Stephen.
Hey, anytime, my friend. This has been a pleasure as always. By the way, folks, we know there's a lot more to unpack there with sleep. We will circle back around to every topic that we cover. We'll eventually take a deeper dive on all of it. This is the essentials. These are the things, the principles that can just kind of help you get started. If you want to take a little bit of a deeper dive into some of this right away, there's a chapter in my book, The Depression Cure, called The Habits of Healthy Sleep. And I unpack a lot of this at length. You don't have to be depressed to benefit from that particular chapter. And there's just a lot of great content. We'll link some in the show notes, all free of charge.
Awesome. The other thing we'd like to talk about is our Patreon. We mentioned last episode, we really appreciate all of you who've joined that. The show is free. It will always be free. Patreon is just basically a way for us to crowdfund some support. So instead of running adverts or sponsors on the show, we basically rely on the generosity of people who love the show and would be sad if it didn't exist and believe in what we're trying to do here and providing free, hopefully somewhat entertaining content around the mental health world. And you can support us for as little as $5 a month. I think there's even a couple of lower options there. And you can find ways to do that in the show notes. You can click on the Patreon link, or if you like to memorize URLs, you can go to patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast. Yes, Stephen, what did you have to say?
That's Dr. Alerted. No. You can bring this, Steve. The only person who calls me Stephen is my mom when I'm in trouble, but that's fine.
Oh, really? Yeah, I always call you Steve, but this whole episode I've been calling you Stephen.
Yeah, well, there may be a method to the madness there. But we do have a couple of patrons who have been extremely generous. People who have the privilege of being at a place in life where they've got some resources and they've generously shared them with us. So if you're listening to this, if you're watching this, and you want to give a more generous gift, we're certainly going to be extraordinarily grateful for that. We get excited about everyone who joins us, who partners with us. If they're giving $2 a month, we're ecstatic. But if you can give a gift that's many orders of magnitude higher than that, that would be awesome as well. So just want to put that out there. You know who you are.
Awesome. Steve, thank you very much for today. Really appreciate it as always. Thank you very much to everyone who is listening or watching. We really can't wait to touch base with you again next time. And thank you for joining us on today's episode.
Thanks, everyone. Be well.
See ya.
Ciao.